Welcome to AI Snacks with Romy and Robbie, an AI literacy podcast. I am your host, Anastasia, CEO and founder of AI Edutainment, a company focused on bringing the knowledge and understanding of AI and robotics into families, schools, businesses of all sizes, and into nonprofit organizations. Today's episode is about distant and maybe even dystopian scenarios of what powerful technologies might mean for the humanity. I am bringing in John Rodriguez Carlos, a retired Royal Australian Air Force Wing Commander who served for about 42 years in a range of operational and leadership roles across Australia and on overseas deployment. And today, John is a science fiction writer, and we are talking cryonics, AI, and the futures we dare to imagine. In Awaking, the first novel of the cryonic dream cycle, a doctor reanimates a long-deceased cryopreserved patient and is thrown into a political and ethical maelstrom. Let me set up the scene. Modern cryonics is no longer just a sci-fi idea, and several companies today offer whole body and brain preservation and ultra-low temperatures for six-figure sums. And revival remains speculative and unproven. But behind the scenes, real cryopreservation is already standard in medicine and biotechnology. Just think freezing eggs, embryos, and tissues. Researchers are pushing new cryoprotectants and protocols that could one day scale from cells to organs and even entire bodies. AI is beginning to act as the hidden operator in cryonics adjacent technologies. Machine learning systems are being used to optimize cryopreservation curves so tissues cool uniformly. AI monitors cryogenic chambers in real time, predict and prevent equipment failures before these failures compromise what is stored. So researchers are exploring AI-driven modeling of how complex biological structures respond to extreme cold, which is prerequisite for even theorizing about safe rewarming and recovery. And many movies and books have used cryonics or cryogenic sleep as a central device to explore time, identity, and the future. Just think Demolition Man, a movie from 1993, when a cop and a criminal are cryogenically frozen and awakened decades later. Or think a movie from 1991 called Late for Dinner. And there, two men are frozen in the 60s and thought 30 years later to experience emotional family drama and the quest of what memory and displacement mean. So ultimately, all science fiction artifacts mirror us humans, and they open a door to reflect on what might be, what is in our hands, and whether at some point in time we give up or rise beyond of what we believed is in our power. So let me open the studio to John Rodriguez Carlos. John, welcome to my show. It's so nice to see you.
Thank you for having me on your show, Anastasia.
Before we start talking about your book and your writing, could you please talk a little bit about yourself, emphasizing maybe 3 to 4 crucial moments that led you to where you are today?
Okay. Well, my background is in the Royal Australian Air Force. So I joined a long time ago when I was young, and I actually came through the ranks. I joined it as an enlisted man and then got my commission after I raised my education a little bit. So, and then eventually went on to become a senior officer. I've done 42 years of service, and after which I retired. But my connection with uniform goes even further back to high school, because I was in what we call the cadets. In the States, I think they call it ROTC. And so I've been in uniform since I was about 14 years old.
And now you are a writer, so how do and you now, bridge?
Well, I've always had a creative element, I think, because I used to love to draw. I did art in high school, and But I was always torn between my creative side and my sense of duty, if you like. So I want to do something worthwhile. So that's why I joined the military. I went through high school and I was going to go to university, do go that way, but I didn't quite make the grade. So instead I joined the military. And while I was in the military, as I said, I improved my education and decided to stay. So the military for me has always been something I wanted to do it because it really gave me a sense of purpose, and that was important for me. So, but from there, that creative side, I tried to nurture as much as possible, but it was always difficult because in the military, you have to have this very focused, logical mindset, and it doesn't always allow for creativity. So it wasn't until towards the end of my career, I thought, well, what am I going to do when I finish, when I retire? So I decided, well, I've always wanted to create. So, and throughout my military career, I did become adept at writing. So it was business writing. So I decided, well, I'll do some writing, creative writing. But so once I retired, one of the things I did do was I did some courses in creative writing just to change the mindset, to make sure I was on the right path. And just that helped me. And that's what led me to write my first novel.
Well, congratulations. I loved your book. And obviously, my podcast is AI-centric, and you write Cryonic Dreams. This novel imagines a future where AI enables and challenges what it means to resurrect consciousness. And what inspired you to use AI as a mediating force between different worlds, life, death, and agency in your story?
Well, cryonics, the idea for using cryonics actually came from a bad dream I had a long time ago. It was the dream briefly was I dreamt of a woman inside a cryo preservation chamber, and it opened up and she stepped out into this dark room and started walking into the darkness. Now, at some point, it's a bad dream, so I swapped places with her at some point, and I was looking into this dark room and these hands were coming up from the floor saying, "You do not belong, you do not belong." So a bit scary, but from the moment I woke up, I thought I really have to use this in a project, and it was automatic for me. So as soon as I decided on the story, I thought, well, I'm going to use the cryopreservation. I don't know what was in the back of my my mind, but hey. So the cryopreservation is also a metaphor in the book for, you know, identity and preservation of what's important. So that's how I also used it in the book. Cryopreservation is a technology we're only just starting to really delve into. And there's, like you said earlier, there's a lot of people who are getting themselves cryopreserved. But it's important to note that if you're going to go down this path, it has to happen within moments of death, because it's before, you know, the body starts to break down. And that's where you got to capture it and preserve it at that point. Because if you wait too long, then no amount of freezing or reanimation is going to be able to revive you. So it's important to note that. That's at least the way I see it. Who knows, in 1,000 years, we may be able to turn back the hands of, you know, decay. I don't know. But certainly from the research I've done, the brief research I've done, who helped me write the book, that's what I did know. There's a lot of trials going on right now in the science of how to preserve without damaging, so to freeze the body without damaging it. And I don't know about if you know anything about the process, but it's the vitrification process that actually destroys the cells. So you've got a way of freezing the body but keeping the cells intact, so that the freezing process doesn't destroy the sensitive structures or delicate structures. And they're working on all sorts of things. In the book, I use the a noble gas, xenon, and they use that to create, they pump it into the body there so that it creates what they call clathrates, or a matrix of a microscopic matrix around all the cell structures. So when they freeze the temperature, normally under pressure, then that helps maintain the delicate structures within the body. You know, reading all that, I certainly get the sense it's a matter of when, not if, the science will be able to actually preserve us.
It's quite interesting. So to my knowledge, there are approximately between 500 and 600 people worldwide that are currently cryonically preserved. Obviously, we do not know what will be the outcomes when at some point in time they might be reanimated. And I am aware that there are thousands of people on waiting list to actually expose themselves to this procedure. And you describe, so this moment of awakening in the future for your protagonist. And
yes.
This woman faces immense psychological and societal shock when she wakes up in a world which is completely foreign to what she was used to have around her. And then you have obviously thought through what would be this moment, what helps to kind of, you know, carry out the process, the procedure. You have AI characters in your book. So how did you put together this concept of the process, and what would be her first moments in the new world, and how she would kind of, you know, cope with the new reality?
There's a lot in that question. How I came up with the process in reverse, now I don't have it on my website yet, but I have produced an entire technical submission supposedly written by Dr. Michelle Brown requesting approval for the procedure. And in there it lists out the whole process. So that will be on my website eventually. But all I did was, because of the research I did, I got sort of a rough understanding of best way that they've, or the best processes they've used currently in science to preserve complex organisms. So all I did was sort of extrapolated that a little bit and then did it in reverse. So it's a quick thaw, and then there was five stages of the reanimation. The second last is actually resuscitation and then recovery. So, it'll be on my website probably in the next couple of months. It's just things I've been working on to support the.
Maybe you reveal to my audience who Michelle is, because I read the book, but many of those who are listening to us have not read it yet. And of course, we will put all the information on the show notes.
So it's Dr. Michelle Brown. She's the doctor in the future that brings back reanimates the other woman, which is Mary Ann Kendricks. So, and I think I saved myself a lot of problem, because when she wakes with no memory, so she doesn't recall her past. And I wanted to go down that path because she, as part of the process after she is reanimated, is about finding out who she was and how she's connected to the future and all the things that happened as a result of her reanimation. So, and so that then goes into the metaphor about preservation of identity and the things that are important for our future. So, so I went down that path. I gave her amnesia so that there is this process of discovery afterwards. And that's how, in a way, that's how she's coping. She doesn't know anything about the future other than it's a very dark future. And she needs to know who she was and how she was connected.
And it's quite interesting because, so today, there are kind of two paths on how to live the afterlife. So one path is obviously, so the cryonic preservation. And another path, quite a few people are dreaming about, is to preserve themselves digitally. So exist like some type of a digital consciousness in the computer.
This consciousness, that's transhumanism.
Yeah, exactly. It could be accessed by loved ones or someone who will be born in the future. How kind of, you know, do you think about those two concepts?
I do.
Why did you pick the cryonic preservation?
The other option will come up, and you might see a little of it in part two, but it will be in more detail in part three. So for me, when we're talking about these options about extending life, it depends on whether you believe in whether we have a soul, for example. Because if there is a soul connected to who we are, then I think going down the cryonics path is that you capture the soul, you preserve the soul because you freeze the body on death, right? On the moment of death. So therefore, the soul doesn't escape. Whereas in transhumanism, if you're downloading information, there is no soul invested in that. It is just a copy of who you are into a digital machine. So will you be able to reflect and think as you currently do now as a biological organism? Or will it be different? Would it be more calculated, more meaningless? It's more like a computer processing rather than a human thinking. So that's where I believe the difference is.
You know, they are quite a lot of researchers in AI, because, you know, it's not just about the soul, but it's about what does it mean to be intelligent. And Mark Stegmark, who is an astrophysicist, and he wrote Life 3.0, a book about the nascent AI. He's believing that intelligence is ultimately information processing. Obviously, a human being processes information, but a cat does too, a worm does too. So they might be machines processing information, so hence they are intelligent. But what is the degree of this notion being intelligent? And quite a bit of researchers believe that you require embodiment. So obviously, so this intelligence connected to a certain shell. And obviously, we know about humanoid robots, but robots might have another shape. Do we require humanoid robots in our society to complete certain tasks? Obviously, we're still in the very beginning of this technology, and we don't have quite a comprehensive architecture, software-wise and hardware-wise, to replicate the complexity of something like a real biological cat. And I don't even want to go into the human being. So how do you think about this kind of, you know, concept of intelligence versus consciousness and versus then soul? They're the same? Are they so interlinked that you can't really deviate from one to another without hurting one? So what is your idea here?
Now, this gets very complicated very quickly. I'm actually working on a thesis, and it's about a multidimensional, the consciousness links to the quantum universe at the, you know, that subatomic level. And there is physics and science behind this. I think it's the Orc theory. So, and I haven't, there's a lot more work to be done on this. So this is me very, very quickly. And this is where my concept of the soul comes in, because the soul is what links the quantum universe to our consciousness. And so it makes our ability to change reality possible. And when we share reality together, a shared reality, then there is a more probabilistic opportunity of that happening, of that future happening, or that reality happening. So again, I'm still working through this. So, and it's very complicated. So I'll leave it at that. But that's basically the skeleton of it, if you like.
Well, but I think it's beautiful, because here you described your fundamental belief on soul being this element general unifier between the multiverse. And of course, there is the multiverse theory in quantum physics, and quite famous physicists, so like David Deutsch, they truly believe it. And there are some sophisticated proof that this is actually the case, in opposition to the world being just just one thing, but you use certain concepts in your book which help those people to navigate between the worlds. And you use a lot of AI characters. So
correct.
Why did you start thinking AI in this domain? And what role does AI and robots, robotic technologies, what do these technologies do in your book for your protagonists, for the whole environment? So how do you think about AI in this distant future you describe?
AI is, whether we like it or not, it's part of our future. It just depends on how it is used. Now, it's not just me, but there are a lot of people suggesting that we need to tread very carefully about how we use it and how we move into the future. Now, some of the AI in my book, it goes down a dark path, but for the main, I keep it in the positive. But I do delineate between, if you like, the elements of the story which are on the positive side or on the protagonist side against the darker elements of the agency. But just to give you an example of some of the AIs in the book, we have the most important character, and she is one of the protagonists, is Holly. Now, she is a hospital operations and logistics intelligence, and she runs the entire Mendel Research Institute and Hospital. And she appears, she has an avatar, and she appears to the people that allow her to appear or to manifest as a 12-year-old girl. What I was doing there was just showing the innocence of just pure information, right? And that's why Holly is the way she is. But then she becomes the point of misuse, and that takes the story into the other trajectory. But there are other, I do have a lot of other minor AI in the book, and we have, for example, Clive, who's the city location inventory venue and entertainment AI. And then there's Karen, who is the city augmented reality and neural network. And she basically looks after what I call the living profile of the citizens. And then there's Harry, the historical and archival records intelligence. And then Mavis, who's a mansion and vicinity immaculate system. And probably there's a couple other ones which have a bigger mention. There's hospital, there's Helen, home environment logistics and entertainment network, and EVA, extra environmental and vital analysis. So they're some of the ones that I've used. The darker one is associated with robotics, and that's a character I call X-Nihilate, and he's a biopolymer mechanical humanoid robot with a dark, very dark, sinister side, and he's controlled by his own AI, artificial intelligence. In the story, the future I painted is not necessarily a rosy picture, because yes, I see the world being very shaped, purposely shaped by people in power, particularly after we have global automation. Now, global automation comes in the shape of AI and robotics, and I put those two together in suggesting that once that occurs, then for many people, what are they going to do to make their lives meaningful and to give themselves purpose? So I think, I mean, not it already exists now where people have just already given up on living. So a lot of nihilism. But particularly after this event, what is left? A lot of people are just going to say, what's the point? And not everybody can create masterpieces. So not everybody's going to be able to create. So that's going to leave and we will create jobs, but it'll be ridiculous jobs. And I use an example like your personal toenail cutter, because what is left after everything is automated? And that's the sort of future that I've gone down in the book. And then it becomes even worse when the people who are in charge and are no longer elected, they will look at the average person as a parasite, because we're going to be expendable, because what do we add to our society? And for them, the answer is going to be not much. We're just living off them, you know, and they're paying a universal basic income to every person on the planet to exist. So these are the hurdles we've got to get through as we forge our future with artificial intelligence and robotics. We've got to take all these things into account and try and navigate the dangers and hopefully, as I call, find the second enlightenment.
So your starts at your trilogy. So the first book is published. Have you already finished the second? So what is
almost
the process right now? Okay. And
almost.
When are we going to expect the release date for the second book?
Hopefully it'll be around the middle of this year. So around June, July.
Wonderful. Wonderful. Maybe I will bring you back to discuss the second.
Absolutely.
And, you know, I'm always kind of, you know, fascinated because from the point of view, what we have today in tech, we are still really decades away from what you describe as a possibility in the book. But I'm always thinking about this, you know, expectation management and being prepared because so there is this metaphor. What if we receive a call from a distant civilization, then let's say 80 or 100 years from now, the aliens arrive on our planet. And this is the scenario of three-body problem, right? What are we going to do? So right now, when I think about AI and AI literacy in the society, and this is obviously my subject, I see that very few governments prepare their citizens for whatever future might come with AI. People are more or less clueless on what AI does and what it can do potentially. What is the state of AI architectures today? What is still missing? People are even not aware that when they communicate with ChatGPT or Claude, those machines are not answering because they don't even understand we are using language and this is a human language.
That's correct. Yes.
So we are still quite away from, you know, a total comprehension of the today's environment and the environment altogether. There is no world model embedded into contemporary technologies. Having said that, we must think in scenarios. And you paint one scenario. I thought it was very interesting because this kind of, you know, city administration, so the powerful people, they try to prevent another pandemic in the book. And probably you were inspired by the recent COVID outbreak.
I'll just add that I actually came up, because when I started writing, I wanted to know, to pick a dystopian future. And I thought, which way am I going to go? And I picked pandemic, and that was before COVID.
Very interesting.
Yeah. So I had picked it already.
Kind of funny, because yesterday I attended a dinner. There was a student of biochemistry participating in this dinner, and she was talking about the cycles of pandemics worldwide, and she was talking about those 20 years cycle that every 20 years we have another outbreak, maybe not on the magnitude when the whole planet is kind of, you know, immersed in this emergency, but we have outbreaks. So it is quite an event, and you painted what you painted. I'm quite curious, when you write, is it something what you really envision, or is it a warning for you? And do you know whether your peers in sci-fi, whether they paint what they are fearful of, or whether they just kind of put something on the display in front of us, and it's up to us to decide, are we going this path, are we not going this path, what do we shape? As a society where technologies, people are mangling together?
Well, it's allegory as speculative evidence. I went through a process personally. So I created a mind map of the psychological and main variables that impacted human progress from the beginning, if you like. And from that, I created a set of variables that I looked at what was coming, and so I grouped these ideas, these thoughts together using the mind map, and then I extrapolated those events, and I actually came up with the timeline that I've got in the beginning of the book. What I was personally trying to do is model a speculative future, right? So I was looking at what's happening now, what's immediately in front. Is it continuing? What's going to happen if nobody stops it? And that's the outcome. So these is what I saw coming. Whether other sci-fi authors use something similar, I don't know. I think in most cases, I think science fiction is used as a warning. People can foresee by extrapolation of what's happening and see that there are issues that we've got to address. And so for me, science fiction writing is about that. It's about looking down the track and saying there's a big bump in the road coming and we need to be aware of it and we need to work out how we're going to get around it. So
I think this is very important what you are saying, because it's about human motivation. Why do humans write? And because of my trade, so educating people about AI, so, you know, sometimes it's really about discussing concepts like what is the transformer architecture, what is the attention head, etc., what is a neuron, and what are the differences between biological neurons and artificial neurons. But I'm quite often encountered with those fears that AI will replace human writing. And this is something I do not believe, because, you know, it might put some humans on the path of stopping developing creative skills.
Yes.
And cognitive skills, frankly. Yes. Because
yeah,
obviously writing helps in honing human condition. But then there is this motivation. So why do humans write? Why do you write?
We're meaning-seeking storytelling beings. So we need to find meaning and purpose in our very existence. So we explore, we extrapolate, we invent to find that meaning and give purpose to it. And I think that's the difference between a human mind and AI. Can mimic that process, but it's not the same. Will it ever be the same? I don't know.
And do you use any AIs in writing?
There have, but in writing the story, I refuse to use AI other than maybe for a little editorial, but mainly because I have my own editor, so I send it to her for editing. But minor aspects of editing, I might use the AI to bigger errors I may have made. But in general, like for example, Awakenings, virtually 99.9% my imagination and my processing powers.
We are very similar in this. When I write, I use AI to organize my files.
Yes, exactly.
But I don't use AI to create characters or even to help me with descriptions.
Because that takes the fun out of it.
That's true. That's true. John, I would like to ask you my last question. So when you read, so what type of books do you enjoy? And maybe a couple of sci-fi writers who you believe really foreseen the future the way it is evolving right now.
I think the one that's made the most impact on me is probably Isaac Asimov.
Yes.
And I don't know that I perceive many. One thing that sci-fi writers always get wrong is how long something's going to take. And I always use Blade Runner as an example, because you know, in 1982, the creators thought that we were going to have engineered humans in 2019. Well, they got that very wrong. I mean, we might have the science to actually be able to achieve something like that, but not to the degree. So we always fall short, which is one of the reasons I actually came up with the whole process that I came up with to speculate what the future might look like. Yeah, so I'd have to say Isaac Asimov has had the most impact on me. And so generally reading, I read science fiction and or crime. And I'm a very visual person. I do tend to watch a lot of movies as well and crime shows.
And your favorite among sci-fi movies?
My favorite?
Yes.
There's a lot. There are a few. I can't think of anything recent. And Passenger might be a good one that I like. That was an interesting one. And yes, it has cryopreservation in it, I just realized as well.
Absolutely.
Yeah. So that was a very interesting one. And so in there are the idea of generational starships, which is one of the future books I'll be working on has that covered, as well as cryonics. There's a lot to come.
Wonderful. So I wish you best success. I am very curious about the second cryonic dream. And I will be very happy to have you back on the show. Thank you so much for what you do. Keep going and keep inspiring young writers.
Thanks. And, can I leave you with a closing remark?
Absolutely.
I jotted this down before your show. So if cryonics awakening teaches us anything, it's that technology is never just about machines. It's about who we choose to become when the future arrives. Whether we're talking about cryonics, AI, or robotics, the real story is always human. And that's why conversations like this one matter. Curiously and courageously, with open minds, we need to have these discussions to prepare for the world ahead. We shape it one question, one story, one discovery at a time.
This is beautiful. Thank you so much.
Thank you very much, Anastasia. Thank you very much.
And this concluded another episode of AI Snacks with Romy and Robbie. My podcast exists to democratize AI and robotics for everyone from kids and parents to teachers, executives, and curious lifelong learners. Episodes like this one featuring John Rodriguez Carlos, where science fiction takes a central stage, a part of that mission. Fictional portrayals of AI robots and cryonics give us safe sandboxes to explore power, ethics, bias, and unintended consequences before they show up at scale in the real world. Ultimately, everything in this podcast comes back to human agency. The tools may be statistical and algorithmic, but values, governance, and accountability are still ours to decide. When you understand how AI and robotics work and how they are framed in culture, you are better equipped to demand transparency, push for better design, and choose how you and your children want to live with smart machines. So if you want to take the next step on that journey, start with the first book of the Romy and Robbie series, Romy, Robbie, and the Secrets of Sleep. This book is available at the Romy and Robbie website and on Amazon. And I thank those 9,000 readers who have already purchased this book. And besides, I published an AI literacy blog on my website, aiedutainment.ai, and I now have Substack. I post daily AI-related content on Romy and Robbie Instagram channel and on my LinkedIn. All the information about today's guest, John Rodriguez Carlos, including links to his work and the first book of the Cryonic Dreams trilogy, awaits you in the show notes. So goodbye for now, and I will see you next week.